Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, January 21st, 2021. I'm your reader, Chris Klein. Let's turn now to Eastern Iowa weather. Today, partly cloudy, wind west-northwest, 10 to 20 miles an hour. High today of 34, low of 6. This is in Cedar Rapids. In Iowa City, high of 35 and low of 7. Friday, mostly sunny, cold. In Cedar Rapids with a high of 16 and a low of minus 1. Saturday, increasing clouds, high of 21, low of 19. And Sunday, snow likely, high of 30 and low of 17. The front page today is completely taken up by pictures and articles on the inauguration. So we'll turn the page to Iowa Today. There are two local stories. The first one, counselor says hospital staff harassed him, trans patient. This is written by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Asher Brown sought a job as a mental health counselor for teens, hoping his experiences as a transgender adult would help him guide trans youth going through similar challenges. But when he started working in the Unity Point Health at St. Luke's Hospital inpatient psychiatric unit for adolescents in Cedar Rapids, Brown found coworkers didn't understand or respect gender nonconformity and made fun of trans patients, he reported in a December 11th complaint to the Iowa Civil Rights Commission. Quote, where it should be a safe place, where they can heal, they are met with the same ridicule that got them there in the first place, unquote, Brown, 29, of Cedar Rapids, told the Gazette. Brown's colleagues also harassed him about his gender identity, asking whether he had male genitalia and which gender he found attractive, the complaint states. Coworkers outed him as trans when someone found a GoFundMe page for his previous gender confirmation surgery. When Brown complained, his supervisor was sympathetic but did not seem to take action, he said. A lot of the response I would get from her would be, it would be helpful if you educate that person, Brown said. That's not really my job, to educate people to not be transphobic. Unity Point Health St. Luke's did not respond directly to the allegations in the complaint, but did provide a statement. We respect and recognize all patients and employees regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, age, religion, disability, and gender identity, spokeswoman Sarah Carrizo said. Our team members participate in annual diversity training, and all of our policies supporting equity and diversity are included in hospital policies, which are shared with employees. The Civil Rights Commission didn't acknowledge a complaint unless it proceeds to a public hearing after determination of probable cause. Transgender people are nearly four times as likely to experience a mental health condition as people whose gender identity corresponds with their birth sex, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. When Brown started working at St. Luke's in February 2019, he said he was shocked to hear staff dismiss teens' gender identity, rolling their eyes when describing trans kids and calling them he, she, whatever. Staff also made teens sit at tables according to their sex assigned at birth, Brown said. When Brown allowed a trans male to sit with other boys, another counselor yelled at Brown, the complaint states. Brown didn't think his gender identity was any of his colleagues' business, but they felt differently, sending group snapshots about his body parts and showing him pictures from an LGBTQ dating website, he wrote in the complaint. Things got so bad, Brown said, that he transferred to another floor in August. When he told a supervisor and a human resources representative he was leaving the unit, one replied, "It saddens me that you are looking for other work, but honestly, I understand." The unnamed supervisor wrote in an email included with the complaint, "I would love for you to stay working here, and I hope that we can continue to work towards a healthy and accepting environment for everyone." Brown, who still works at St. Luke's, would like to see the hospital discipline harassers and provide effective training. "People should know about this," he said. "Previous patients who had experiences here deserve to have that validated. For LGBTQ teens thinking about suicide or needing immediate support, the Trevor Project has a hotline at 1-866-488-7386 or an online chat feature. The NAMI helpline also can be reached 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Iowa time, Monday through Friday, at 1-800-950-6264. The second article in Iowa Today is titled "Firm Inundated with Interest in UI Leader Job." This is written by Vanessa Miller for the Gazette. Iowa City. The University of Iowa has been advertising its presidential vacancy officially for just 1 week, but executives leading the search report that "we have absolutely been inundated every day with interest." Although the advertisement for the UI's 22nd president hasn't yet appeared in all the publications planned, AGB Search Managing Principal Roderick J. McDavis told a 21-member search committee Wednesday his team had spent many hours on the phone with interested prospects. "I think that this committee needs to know that the University of Iowa is attracting high-quality candidates already," McDavis said. The UI committee is advertising the position in 12 publications, including The Chronicle of Higher Education, LGBTQ Presidents in Higher Education, and DiverseJobs.net. Applicants have until March 15th to submit a letter of interest, resume, and 5 references. McDavis said his team anticipates connecting with each prospect an average of 3 times. First calls typically involve details about what the UI is looking for in its next president. Second calls address questions from prospects after they've done more research. And third calls usually involve application commitments and deadline discussions. UI President Bruce Harold announced in October, 3 years before his contract was set to expire in 2023, his plans to retire after the Board of Regents hires a successor. Harold's hiring in 2015 sparked blowback for the Regents' rejection of campus-wide criticism of the former IBM executive's candidacy and calls from faculty, staff, and students for Regents to choose another finalist. "Prospects for the presidential job have aired their awareness of that history," said James McCormick, a consultant for an AGB search, which the UI is paying a $90,000 fee plus expenses to help find its next leader. "They've already done their homework," McCormick said Wednesday. "In fact, a number of them already are talking to people at Iowa that they might know." Praising the search committee for following best practice guidance this time, McCormick said he's been happy to put concerns to rest. "The fact that we were able to say this process is outstanding. It's according to best practices, and I don't anticipate any situation that happened the last time to occur this time. I've been complimenting all of you for your hard work," he said, "but there is that discussion of what happened last time." McCormick said questions from people of this caliber are typical. The AGB search officials cautioned there could be many applications coming late in the game from people who consider themselves top prospects for the job. Now we turn to the Insight page. The first article is the Gazette's editorial entitled Poor Priorities in Legislature. We hoped for a serious legislative session focused on COVID-19 pandemic and other pressing issues affecting Iowans. It didn't take long for legislative leaders to show they had other plans. A panel in the Iowa Senate last week approved a bill to allow for the death penalty for certain violent crimes against children. It was the first piece of legislation to advance in the new General Assembly. At best, fast-tracking a bill aimed at an extremely specific set of crimes while a deadly disease outbreak continues to spread largely uncontrolled demonstrates poor priorities among Republicans who control the legislative agenda. Even in normal times, though, reinstating the death penalty would be bad policy. Capital punishment has been a recurring political issue since Iowa's founding. The first territorial governor advocated against the practice, but legislators codified it anyway. Iowa, in 1878, became the first state to restore the death penalty after previously abolishing it. The modern ban has been in place since 1965. Lawmakers have repeatedly tried to revive the death penalty. Senate Study Bill 1004, approved last week by a Senate subcommittee, calls for the death penalty in cases where someone kidnaps, sexually abuses, and murders a minor. This is particularly heinous series of crimes, and we have little sympathy for such perpetrators. However, the death penalty is costly to administer due to the extensive legal proceedings required. Worse yet, it makes an executioner out of the government, and by extension, all Iowans. This is a heavy moral burden the state should not impose on its citizens. While the Senate Judiciary Committee debates state-sponsored killing, the state's judicial system has been turned on its head for almost a year, Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Susan Christensen said in her condition of the judiciary remarks last week. Jury trials were suspended twice last year amid COVID-19 case surges and now are set to resume in February. No thanks to the legislature. The courts are adapting to meet the challenge. Christensen, in her speech, touted programs that would actually help children, such as family-first policies to avoid child removal and family treatment courts to help parents transition out of the corrections system. Lawmakers' attention would be much better spent supporting and expanding those programs rather than on a misguided campaign to revive the death penalty. We have one community letter today, submitted by Kurt Zingula of Central City, entitled, Climate Change is Being Weaponized with Fear. Common sense is not so common. That's evident in the attempts to change climate change. We're told that climate change is an existential threat to both humanity and Earth. Yet, alleged solutions to this dire prediction are merely an attachment to a huge contentious welfare legislation bill known as the Green New Deal. Shouldn't saving humanity merit legislation separate from free college tuition? The United States is reducing its carbon footprint. Meanwhile, China is involved with building or planning over 300 coal-fired plants lasting decades for themselves and other cheaters committing to a Paris Climate Agreement. He quotes NPR April 29, 2019. Consequently, it makes no sense to support Paris climate bureaucrats who ignored their mission and allowed China to increase greenhouse gas emissions for 15 years before reducing from a higher level. Common sense tells us that not all climate change will be bad. NOAA reports that the incidence of EF3 and stronger tornadoes is declining. Thousands of laboratory and field studies have shown that plant growth and yield increased when more CO2 was available. Those are just two of the many benefits associated with climate change that are either censored or disregarded because one group's ignorance is another group's opportunity. Common sense warns me that the term climate change, when weaponized with fear, is synonymous with manipulation. Again, this was submitted by Kurt Zingula of Central City. Next is 24-Hour Doorman by Todd Dorman's submission called A New Day, But Iowa is Still Trumpy. So the country has moved on from Donald Trump, but in Iowa, some of the former president's strongest backers and enablers still run the joint. Sort of takes the fizz out of the champagne. Our Republican legislature and the new Biden administration will be giving us a split-screen view of governing in the months ahead. President Joe Biden will work to put a strong federal pandemic response and vaccination plan on track. In Des Moines, Republicans will keep praising Governor Kim Reynolds for her embrace of Trump's do as little as possible approach to the coronavirus. Health experts will guide the federal response. Ours will be guided by leaders who refuse even to wear masks in the Capitol. Biden will be pushing to help Americans struggling with the pandemic's fallout, economic fallout. In Des Moines, lawmakers will be looking to help wealthy earners with another round of tax cuts. The new administration will be putting environmental protection back on the front burner. In Des Moines, agriculture interests will continue to control our environmental policy. In Washington, improving public education will be a priority. In Des Moines, they'll be working on vouchers for private schools. Among the first bills to move ahead in Des Moines is one reinstating a limited death penalty. They're pushing for constitutional amendments restricting abortion rights and basically abolishing gun regulation. Priorities, folks. So there's no new day dawning in Des Moines, just more of the same. We've also got three new Republican U.S. representatives in Iowa. Each one looked upon the horrors of January 6th and then voted against impeaching a president who incited a violent attack on Congress. Why did they run if they have so little regard for the institution they've joined and the lives of their colleagues? U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson argued holding Trump accountable would cause further division. But she solidly backed a president whose entire strategy was to divide us and turn anger into power. Quote, I'm never going to stop arguing for the things he championed, unquote, said Hinson, of a president who perpetuated the big lie about a stolen election and mismanaged the crisis of our generation. Good news is that with Trump gone, Iowans might start to see their own Trumpian state and federal leaders differently. If Biden manages to score some successes, it may make more of the same feel more like falling behind. A long shot, I admit. More Iowans might decide a pro-corporate, pro-big ag agenda seasoned with myths about voter fraud, tired culture war outrage, and downplaying a pandemic isn't making Iowa better. After billions of dollars in tax cuts over the last 25 years, maybe Iowans will start wondering whether it's really true that cutting revenues while underfunding schools, universities, our mental health system, and other priorities is the right formula. But hey, we've got a big surplus. It's an agenda benefiting the guys with private jets, but not so much the rest of us. Trumpism, at last, was rejected by the nation, and Iowa Republicans who think they can win even if their party continues to be a backward bastion of bad ideas should think again. Cheers. On the inside page is another op-ed piece by Star Parker, a syndicated columnist, called Freedom of Speech Slipping Away. As the new Biden-Harris administration assumes power, the most basic American freedom of speech and expression is under unprecedented threat. For the first time, I am concerned about my freedom to do my work, to run a policy institute addressing issues of culture, race, and poverty from a conservative perspective. In a survey just published by the Pew Research Center, 86% say they often or sometimes get their news from a digital device, smartphone, tablet, or computer. According to Statista.com, the United States has 223 million Facebook users, almost the size of the entire U.S. population over age 18. Per Pew, 22% of U.S. adults use Twitter. These developments have put enormous power at the disposal of technology firms over what we see and read. The decision to kick the President of the United States off Twitter, disconnecting him from the 89 million who follow him, is mind-boggling. President Donald Trump turned to social media as his platform of preference to communicate with the country because of widespread bias in the mainstream media. What gives the technology companies so much discretion over communication, the oxygen of our free country? This comes from a provision of the 1996 Communications Decency Act that was passed to set the ground rules for the powerful new technologies that were emerging. Technology companies are protected from liability for the content they carry. The liability exists with whomever provided that content, but they were also given discretion over what they choose to carry. The discretion part comes from logic that the operators of these platforms should be able to refuse inflammatory, dangerous content. But what about content that is normally protected by the First Amendment? Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, appointed himself judge and jury, deciding that Trump incited the assault on the Capitol and banning the president. If Donald Trump broke the law, this should be determined through legal channels, not by the subjective decision of a business person with a net worth of some $12 billion accrued because of American freedom. I produce a weekly television talk show, Cure America with Star Parker. The show was booted off Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O, because the far-left Southern Poverty Law Center identifies one of our Christian advertisers as a hate group, and one pastor said that homosexuality is a sin. Now, quoting the Bible, expressing views of a believing Christian is out of bounds. Banned from the nation's major media platforms? Fortunately, many are now concerned. The argument is made that First Amendment speech protections only pertain to government action, not private companies. But technology has enabled a concentration of private power not previously imagined. The Communications Decency Act could be amended such that speech on technology platforms receives the same protections as all speech protected by the First Amendment. Another possibility would be to amend the Civil Rights Act to include those with religious conviction based on teachings of Judaism and Christianity as a protected class. Here are two more Iowa Today articles on page 7A. The first one is submitted by Kat Russell for the Gazette. Iowa reports 1,359 new COVID-19 cases, 62 deaths. Iowa on Wednesday reported 1,359 COVID-19 cases and 62 confirmed deaths. The seven-day average of new cases is 1,097. The new cases reported by the Iowa Department of Public Health between 11 a.m. Tuesday and 11 a.m. Wednesday bring the state's total number of virus cases to 307,595 and the state's death toll to 4,394 since last March. The new cases were found in 4,215 COVID-19 tests in the 24-hour period for a one-day positivity rate of 32.2%. 14 of Iowa's 99 counties reported 14 positivity rates above 15%, a significant decrease from the last week, according to a Gazette analysis. Linn County reported 57 new cases Wednesday. The county's seven-day average is 48. To date, 17,799 virus cases have been reported in the county, and 278 people have died. Johnson County added 41 new cases. The county's seven-day average is 44. Since March, Johnson County has reported 12,126 cases and 51 deaths. Hospitalizations. Iowa saw a decline in the number of hospitalizations, dipping from 490 on Tuesday to 474 on Wednesday, according to state public health data. The number of patients being treated in intensive care inched up from 85 to 86. The number of patients on ventilators remained at 36. Vaccines. A total 35,990, 150 COVID-19 vaccine doses have been distributed throughout the United States. That's 35,990, 150 vaccine doses have been distributed throughout the United States, with about half of them, 16,525, 281, administered according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In Iowa, 291,075 doses have been distributed according to the CDC, and 156,298 doses have been administered according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. State data shows 122,588 individuals have received the first dose of the vaccine series, and 16,854 have received both doses in the two-shot regimen. In Linn County, 12,125 doses have been administered, and 11,894 Linn County residents have been vaccinated. In Johnson County, 20,040 doses have been given, and 13,370 Johnson County residents have been vaccinated. Long-term care. 72 long-term care facilities in Iowa reported outbreaks Wednesday, down one from the previous 24-hour period. According to the data, 1,886 individuals in long-term care facilities are positive for the virus, an increase of 61 from the previous 24-hour period. Since March 1st, 806 individuals have died. In Johnson County, cases at Lantern Park Specialty Care rose slightly from 32 to 33 cases, while the number of recoveries shifted from 27 to 26. In Buchanan County, ABCM Rehabilitation Centers of Independence was removed from the state's outbreak list. The next article is titled, 14-Year-Old Pleads to Arm Robbery. This was written by Trish Mahaffrey of the Gazette. Cedar Rapids. A 14-year-old Ely boy pleaded guilty to a lesser charge in adult court Wednesday in an armed robbery of a liquor and tobacco store last September. Triton Spies, S-P-I-E-S, originally charged with first-degree robbery, pleaded to second-degree robbery. Spies, according pointed a loaded handgun at a cashier September 30th at the Point Liquor and Tobacco Store, 3221 Center Point Road, Northeast, while demanding she give him money from the register, according to a criminal complaint. Spees admitted to investigators he planned the robbery with an accomplice, Dechary V. Steele, 28 years old, of Chicago, Illinois, and was armed with a loaded Springfield XD 9mm handgun, according to court records. Spees fled from the store in a vehicle Steele was driving, the complaint states. A judge previously moved Spees' case from juvenile court to district court because it was a violent crime involving a weapon. Because of Spees' age, 6th Judicial District Judge Ian Thornhill accepted the plea agreement as a youthful offender prosecution. Thornhill will send Spees back to juvenile court, where a judge will send him for treatment to a juvenile facility until the teen is 18. At that time, Spees will return to district court, where a judge will sentence him to a 10-year prison term, give him probation, or discharge him for time served. The judge's decision will be based on how well Spees progresses at the juvenile facility and any treatment. Steele is charged with first-degree robbery, conspiracy to commit a forcible felony, and carrying weapons. Judge Mitchell Turner lowered Steele's $50,000 cash-only bail to $35,000 cash and allowed him to post 10%. Steele paid $3,500 bail and was released in November pending trial. No trial date is set at this time. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, January 21st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Dolores Joan Dinger, 78, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, died Tuesday, January 19th at Mercy Medical Center, Cedar Rapids. Services will be held at a later date. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service assisted the family. Eugene C., better known as Gene Halstead, 65, died suddenly Monday, January 18th at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. Gene had always said no fuss about me when I die, so no public services are being planned. Down the road, his family and friends will gather to remember their son, brother, uncle, and friend. Sherry, maiden name Ernst Pilarczyk, 52, of Cedar Rapids, died unexpectedly at her home on Monday, January 18th. Private services will be held, burial at Mount Calvary Cemetery. The funeral mass for Sherry will be live-streamed. Please check. Gerald, better known as Jerry, D. Rasmussen, 73, passed away Monday, January 18th, at the hospice unit at Unity Point Healthcare, St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, where he was surrounded by his siblings. A celebration of life will be at a later date. Angela May Savoda. They do not give her age. The paper also does not say the day she died, but it continues. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the service. Burial will take place at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Anne Marie Maiden Espy Harris. All Anne Marie Harris, 63, of Cedar Rapids, died from complications of COVID-19 pneumonia on Wednesday, December 9th at St. Luke's Hospital. Before the service on January 23rd, it will be held at Cedar Hills Community Church in Cedar Rapids on January 23rd. Before the service, there will be a visitation from 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. A private burial will occur at a later date. Eric Eugene Bubba Watson, 55, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, January 19th in his home. Public visitation will be from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, January 24th at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Private Celebration of Life services will be at Kingdom Encounter Church, located at 701 25th Street Northeast. Private Family Internment will be at a later date. Teresa Maxine Green, age 93, died on Tuesday, January 19th. At Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. A private family funeral mass will be held at St. Joseph Catholic Church in North English. Burial will be in the St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Sigourney. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, January 21st at the Powell Funeral Home in North English. Alan E. Willman, 71, of Wyoming, passed away on Monday, January 18th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A public visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to noon, Saturday, January 23, at the Calkins Barn in Wyoming. A private graveside service will be held at the Wyoming Cemetery. In other notices, in Decorah, Patricia Fitch, 82, died Wednesday, January 20th. Schluter Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. Festina, Phyllis Lechtenberg, 97, died Tuesday, January 19th. Schluter Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. Gutenberg, Marvin Carl Haller, 87, died Tuesday, January 19th. Tuke Allen Funeral Home of Gutenberg is assisting the family. Now we turn to the sports page. In the sideline information, college basketball, Kirkwood men upset on the road in opener. The Kirkwood men's basketball team, the preseason number one in NJCAA Division II, dropped its season opener to 15th-ranked DMACC 75-70 last night in Boone. The Eagles host their first home game Saturday against Northeast. The women play at 1 p.m., the men at 3. Kirkwood women open season with victory. The Kirkwood women's basketball team opened its season with a 70-63 victory over DMACC last night in Boone. The Eagles, who trailed 40-38 at halftime, buckled down defensively in the second half, giving up only 23 points. Freshman Carson Stratton led the Eagles 1-0 in scoring with 20 points. Freshman Dominic Rodriguez knocked down 4 3-pointers to finish with 12 points. College track and field. Iowa hosts 5-team invitational this weekend. The Iowa track and field team hosts Illinois, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Wisconsin this weekend at the 5th annual Larry Wojcik Invitational. Field events begin at 1 p.m. Friday, while track events start at 5:20 p.m. at the University of Iowa Rec Building. Competition on Saturday begins at noon for field events, while track events begin at 1 p.m. There will be a live stream of the weekend's action on BTN Plus and the BTN Plus mobile app. Now to Iowa football. Future Hawks get a head start. This is written by Leah Van for the Gazette. The Iowa football team will welcome 6 of its 2021 recruits to campus on January 25th. As spring football approaches, here's a look at who is getting a head start at making an impact on the Hawkeyes. Connor Colby and David Kov come in as 4-star recruits, both top in their position from their respective states. David Koff, a 6'6", 295-pound tackle from New Trier High High School in Winnetka, Illinois, caught the interest of 17 schools, including 10 from the Big Ten. Davidkoff is a multi-sport athlete with rugby and wrestling experience, but didn't have a senior season on the football field since Illinois postponed high school football until February 2021. Colby, a 6'5", 305-pound guard from Cedar Rapids, Kennedy, isn't straying far from home to play for his dream school. Colby is a three-year varsity veteran and a number four in the state of Iowa at his position. What separates him from most high school offensive linemen is his tenacity and his ability to finish, Kennedy head coach Brian White said. Connor always gets the last push. That's the type of style Iowa is known for. But what's also unique about Colby is his sense of style, specifically his mullet, which he started growing his sophomore year. I'm a kid of the 80s, so it's fantastic. Quote, boy, it's flowing, even had a curl in it. The funny thing is, if you look around, young kids everywhere are starting to grow out these big mullets. But Connor is fantastic, unquote, White said. Keegan Johnson and Arland Bruce IV hope to make an immediate impact on the Hawkeye roster following the departures of Emir Smith-Marset and Brandon Smith. Johnson has Nebraska fans like his dad and high school coach jumping on the Iowa bandwagon. He comes from a long line of football athletes. His dad, Clester Johnson Sr., was a wingback for two national championship-winning teams at Nebraska in 1994 and 95. Johnson's older brother, CJ and Cade, brothers CJ and Cade, also played football at Wyoming and South Dakota State, respectively. At 6'1", 190 pounds, Johnson played both sides of the ball for his high school team, Bellevue West, which won a Class A state championship in 2019. With four wide receivers on the roster during his sophomore year, Johnson played quarterback. You don't put someone with his talents standing on the sideline playing 15 snaps a game. That's stupid, Bellevue West coach Michael Huffman said. Bruce's transfer to Ankeny High School for his senior football season made national headlines last fall, even capturing the attention of Kansas City Chiefs star Patrick Mahomes, who tweeted his support. Bruce cleared to play five games into the season, aided in Ankeny's state championship season alongside fellow Iowa recruit Brody Brecht. Bruce caught seven passes for 58 yards and rushed for 91 yards on 14 carries in the Hawks' 42-14 state title defeat of Southeast Polk. Bryce played quarterback during his sophomore year at Olathe North High School, then running back the following year. At Ankeny, he played running back and wide receiver, but has recently focused his efforts at receiver, hoping he can be a target in the slot. They did tell me I have a chance to play, but the best players play and they don't pick favorites, Bruce said. My top three goals are to get to 200 pounds and not to have redshirt. And not have to redshirt. Tight end. Zach Tweed, that's T-W-E-D-T, never thought he'd be playing college football. If anything, he thought baseball was his future until he garnered interest from college scouts during his freshman year of high school. He first caught the eyes of Iowa State recruiters and saw it as an opportunity to have college paid for. I never had a goal or dream of playing for any specific college, Tweed said. Growing up a farm kid, I just never watched TV. I don't even really watch sports. If I'm sitting behind a TV, I get disappointed in myself because I think about all the things I could be doing to better myself instead of sitting there doing nothing. But through the recruiting process, he saw a home at Iowa because of its culture of recruiting other guys who had grown up with similar lifestyles across the Midwest. At 6'3", 230 pounds, Twett played tight end at Roland Story, but his senior season was cut short by a dislocated shoulder and torn labrum. He spent the season learning about the game from the sidelines while rehabilitating his shoulder, which is now almost at full strength. The first time I watched this kid even just do formation recognition and call out the strength of the defense, he was such a great communicator and got his teammates in the correct position so efficiently, Roland Story football coach Matt Finn said. He's got a really good head for the game. Defensive end. Justin Sullivan, a Rivals four-star weak side defensive end standing at 6'2 and weighing 230 pounds, also didn't expect to be playing college football. Originally from Ghana, Sullivan was adopted at 8 years old and lived in Huxley before moving to Eden Prairie, Minnesota, before high school. His dad, Jake Sullivan, is a former Iowa State basketball star, holding records in free throw percentage and three-pointers made. Sullivan said his coordination wasn't great growing up when he tried playing basketball. When you're younger, you just go run around and tackle, Sullivan said. There's not really much to it, so it was more fun for me to play football than basketball. Sullivan comes from a Minnesota football powerhouse. Eden Prairie won its sectional state championship in an abbreviated bracket due to COVID-19, but was the state runner-up in 2018. Next piece is about Iowa men's basketball, entitled One Battle at a Time. This is written by Mike Hyas for the Gazette. Perhaps the biggest adversary to the Iowa men's basketball team comes from within. No, it's not among the number four Hawkeyes themselves. They seem unified and in harmony as they get ready to play Indiana. 3-4 Big Ten, 8-6. Tonight at 8 inside Carver Hawkeye Arena. A win would get the Hawkeyes to 7-1 in the Big Ten and 13-2 overall and move them back into a tie with Michigan for the league lead. Rather, it's the UI's parking and transportation department. This was tweeted by Iowa senior guard Jordan Bohannon on Tuesday. Quote, flat tire this morning, received ticket at Carver, waiting for tow to come get it, and I have the parking lady yelling at me to move my car. Where do you want me to move it? I have a flat tire, unquote. Followed by, I've officially declared war, no other options at this point, IMO. He had more tweets Wednesday on the campus parking situation. In this a focus shatterer for a player who has averaged 17 points and 5.8 assists in the Hawkeyes' current five-game winning streak while making 62.9% of his three-pointers? Or is the mischievous work of a mischievous guy who was grinning as he said this during his team's weekly Zoom video conference with reporters Wednesday? The parking police, I don't think any of the workers have a soul or a heart at that place. I want to make that known right now. I'm sure they're great people off their jobs, but when they put on that uniform, I'm not sure there's a heart in there. Are we sure there's a focus here? Iowa forward Jack Nung said yes in a more serious answer to a more serious question. Quote, I think from top to bottom, our team has had very acute focus on every single game. We haven't always played the best. We haven't won every game. But keeping the end goal in sight, focusing on what we can control, just bringing our best, changing when we need to change, getting things better that we need to work on, I think that focus on our team this year has been the biggest part. This is a quote from Nung. Indiana coach Archie Miller doesn't sound like he thinks the Hawkeyes need more focus or anything else. They're one of the best teams in the country, that's a given, Miller said Wednesday. But I also think they have a chance not only to win the Big Ten in an unprecedented year, but they also have an opportunity to compete for a national championship. They have all the parts that are needed. Miller doesn't have quite as many parts, but does have 6'9" sophomore forward, Trace Jackson Davis. He averages 20.4 points and 8.9 rebounds. Trace has been a monster so far this season, said Iowa's Patrick McCaffrey. Jackson Davis will be free of worry about the UI parking monitors. The Hawkeyes are not. Actually, McCaffrey said, I got a ticket yesterday with Bohannon because I didn't feel like parking super far away. Unquote. Asked for his off-court strategy, Bohannon again smiled and said, You know me, I always have a plan. I'm not going to formally state it right now, but we'll see what happens in the near future over the Jordan Bohannon versus parking police saga. He doesn't have a plan, McCaffrey told the media shortly after Bohannon's claim. He's lying. Maybe. But those who have opposed Bohannon on the court this month have paid heavy tolls of their own. And finally, Iowa women's basketball. This piece written by Jeff Linder for the Gazette. Bluter, postponement. My decision, 100%. Iowa City. This wasn't a Big Ten decision. It wasn't a University of Iowa decision. This was my decision, 100%. Iowa women's basketball coach Lisa Bluter said. When Tuesday came and Bluter was informed the Hawkeyes Hotel in proximity to Washington, D.C. and the University of Maryland was being taken over by the National Guard, that was it. The Hawkeyes were staying home, even if the action risked forfeiture of today's schedule, Big Ten game, with the Maryland Terrapins. Am I cautious? Yes. I'm paid to play games. I understand that, Bluter said in a Zoom conference call Wednesday afternoon. I made this decision with the health and safety of my team and staff in mind. I would rather be cautious than careless and regretful. The Hawkeyes, 9-3 overall, 5-3 Big Ten, were scheduled for a 4 p.m. Iowa time tip-off with number 7 Maryland, 11-1-7-0, today at College Park. They were slated to fly into Washington, D.C. Wednesday, Inauguration Day. When we got the schedule, I thought it was pretty unusual that we were flying to Maryland on Inauguration Day, Bluter said. Then, with the riots on January 6th, my thoughts turned up to concern. College Park is 9 miles from downtown Washington, a 30-minute drive. The Hawkeyes' original hotel was 10 minutes from campus. Bluter said Maryland officials insisted the Hawkeyes would be safe. I understand that. They live in this area, Bluter said. They said it was perfectly safe. Then when the hotel said the National Guard was taking over the hotel, taking young women to that area with thousands of National Guards, as a mom, would I allow my kids to go there? No. As a coach, I made the same decision. I am responsible for the well-being of the team and the staff, and that is the only concern this decision was based on. Three of Iowa's Big Ten games, all on the road, have been postponed. Ohio State postponed its December 19th game with the Hawkeyes because of COVID-19, and earlier this week, Rutgers did the same with its upcoming game, which was supposed to be Sunday. I'm not confident they'll all be rescheduled, but we're going to try, Bluter said. Iowa's next game is next Thursday at Carver Hawkeye Arena against Northwestern. A tip time has not been established. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, January 21st. I'm your reader, Chris Klein. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.